Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley talking to you on episode 79 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. Our subject today is Lowe's The Big Boss. And this is a film starring Bruce Lee. It was the first film that he made in Hong Kong as a martial arts star, and it kind of launched him to big-time status. And so I'm really excited. We recently heard the Criterion Collection is adding a pretty significant box set to their ever-growing library called Bruce Lee's Greatest Hits. And I've got a couple guests who know a little bit more about this genre than I do. So I'm going to kind of show what I've got to say about it. I've watched the film a couple times now. But let's go ahead and get our guests introduced. And I'll start by introducing Richard Doyle. Richard, you and I are pretty frequent collaborators here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. Good to be here. I'm glad to talk about this film.
Excellent. Yeah, no, just a few weeks ago, you and I did an episode on Shaft, and we kind of spoke about blaxploitation cinema and kind of its, not necessarily its twin, but its kind of ally. It kind of came up out at the same time, kung fu cinema. And we made a reference to the idea that, you know, with rumors circulating that Criterion was going to do a Bruce Lee box, that this would be a good time to, you know, get that into the collection. And here we are just a few weeks later getting ready to talk about the Bruce Lee box. This is before the Criterion announcement, before we knew that The Big Boss was going to be part of that collection. But it is a 1971 film, and so it definitely fits into my timeline. In fact, it's an October 1971 release, so it's right in sequence. We just talked about Fiddler on the Roof in my most recent episode, and here we are switching gears just a little bit from that big-budget Hollywood musical to something just a little different. And my second guest is a guy who's been on the program before, a specialist in the the field of martial arts cinema, and a guy who's had some personal experience in that, working in that genre. Michael Wirth, welcome back to Criterion Reflections.
I can't believe we're here talking about Bruce Lee on your podcast. This is great.
Isn't it awesome? I mean, I am very happy that Criterion has kind of woven Bruce Lee into their ever-growing library of important and classic films. How are you doing, Michael? Let's just kind of get some of the welcomes out of the way before we get into the nitty-gritty of it. But how's things going for you these days?
Things are good. Thank you for asking. I'm using this kind of downtime to do a lot more of the catch up on those things that I put off, like writing and editing, that sometimes when you're bopping around on productions, you don't do as much. So it's been great. You know, I can just kind of sit in weird places where there's no traffic in LA too. That's the other thing. It's like the apocalypse has hit, and you can go from one point to another without taking 5 hours to go four blocks. And it's just, it's great. So no, I've been really happy about that, and so, but it's starting to kind of pick up a little bit now, and which is good, because I think we're all getting a little antsy. We don't want to get, you know, when and our pocketbooks are starting to get a little, I don't know if we have pocketbooks anymore, but they're starting to get a little thin. So it's good to get us back to work. But I'll tell you, I'm really excited to be doing this with you guys. And one of the things that was funny is I occasionally peruse the boards and stuff to see how people are talking about releases, and with this case, with this particular set, I jumped on there and was pleasantly surprised to see the majority of people were actually excited about having this come out rather than being antagonistic towards it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have seen a few people who say, this isn't really my thing, or those films really aren't that good. I mean, you know, maybe giving a little bit of props to Bruce Lee as a performer, as a charismatic screen personality. We will talk about The Big Boss per se and that particular film in time, but I am really pumped. I'm really glad that Criterion has expanded their range, so to speak. They obviously had to license these films. I don't know that they will ever become part of the Janus Films library or that they'll have ownership of them. And these films have been released in different editions. And maybe you guys know a little bit more about the sort of the history or the catalog of Bruce Lee on disc, much more than I do. But this is a great opportunity for me to kind of seriously engage with a performer, really with an artist, a philosopher, a master of his disciplines in a way that I really haven't before, even though I've known about Bruce Lee as a pop culture phenomenon since like Enter the Dragon in the early 70s, right. Kind of thrust it into my consciousness. Of course, there's the song Kung Fu Fighting, the disco anthem from that year, those years. And that's really probably about as far as I've got. I think I saw Enter the Dragon. I think I saw Game of Death kind of in TV edited versions before. And, you know, every time you see Bruce Lee, it's like, wow, that guy's pretty awesome, you know. But I've never really sunk in and settled and said, okay, let me just really study this guy, or let me really even study this genre. And so I just have to put my cards down. I'm a novice to this, but I'm very eager and very willing to engage, and really glad to have this excuse, if you will, to really expand my horizons and say, okay, what's going on here besides or beyond the clearly, you know, obvious, you know, the physical athletics, acrobatics, mm-hmm. you know, the discipline that it takes to be able to perform the moves that Bruce Lee and his, you know, fellow martial artists did on film. So yeah, I
was just going to add to that real quick is that I think when the thing you said that is important about this being a part of the box, this box set being here, is that Bruce Lee, regardless of what you think of his films or what you think of the genre, he was so critical in the rest of the world being not just exposed to martial arts cinema, but Chinese cinema. And so in that sense, there is a real importance to his appearance on the scene. And not only that, where I'm working, actually, I've been working on this for the last few years, is putting together a fairly similar box set, in a sense, with a company out here in Los Angeles that is strictly dedicated to the follow-up films of Bruce Lee, which is an entirely new subgenre, the Bruceploitation movies, you know, that mm-hmm. came out of Bruce Lee. And so, I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, I'm glad we're talking about it. I just wanted to just punctuate this by just saying I think Bruce Lee, regardless of how some of the films may lay in terms of filmmaking techniques, etc., he was really important to cinema in that regard.
Right, he's kind of a world cultural figure, kind of like I don't know, Bob Marley or any number of other performers who really transcended the specific genre or style that they worked in. Just the face, just the sound of the name mm-hmm. is iconic, and I mean that in the most literal sense of the word. You know, he really is, and I as a genre, I imagine that there have been many developments since then, people who perhaps on a purely technical level even outperform Bruce Lee or do things that he didn't do or take the art to a different level. But he is kind of a singular persona. And so I really think it's very appropriate that Criterion would say, yeah, let's go ahead and recognize that. And it seems like they've not only gotten his five, you know, most significant feature films, but there's a lot of incredible supplementary material in that set. And I know that, you know, maybe I'm tipping the hand a little bit here, but you and I and Aaron West plan to do an episode of Criterion Now later this year, where we're going to dig into that box set in greater detail once it's closer to being released.
Yeah.
So we maybe can save some of the, you know, analysis of that particular product until then.
Sure.
And let's keep our focus on The Big Boss, which is, again, a 1971 film. And maybe, Richard, I'll give you a chance to jump in here. Tell me just a little bit about your familiarity with this film and kind of your background in as being a fan of martial arts films and Bruce Lee in particular.
For Lee in particular, I can trace it back to when I was in high school. A friend and I saw a double feature in a big theater in town here in Winnipeg. We saw Enter the Dragon paired with The Big Boss, The Big Brawl, the Jackie Chan film. It's a double feature.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Uh-huh. And that was sort of a formative experience because I wasn't a big fan of martial arts films at that point. I was like maybe 15 or 16 years old, and this double feature blew me away, especially Enter the Dragon. The Big Brawl is sort of an okay film, but Enter the Dragon was quite amazing. And I'd since seen all of the Bruce Lee films many times in almost every format possible. I think one of my first DVD purchases was a DVD set of all of the Bruce Lee films except for Enter the Dragon, which has always not been included in sets because of the different rights on ownership. And I've owned a DVD set. I own the Shout Factory Blu-ray set. I've upgraded some of the individual Bruce Lee titles with the better Shout Factory Blu-rays, and I'm looking forward to this set as kind of bringing all the films together in one spot. I'd say of The Big Boss, this is kind of an interesting film. It fits really well in sort of the chronology of films we've been talking about because it's a nice 1971 film that's a big transformation of its genre. It's kind of a transition from the way martial arts films were made in the 60s to the way they end up being made in the 70s. And quite interestingly, you can kind of see the transformation happen in the middle of this film, about 45 minutes in. So as soon as Bruce Lee actually has his first big fight scene, you see the old style of the older style of martial arts fighting turn into the new style right in the middle of the film.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. I want to kind of maybe give Michael a chance to elaborate on that. You and I, Michael, we talked about Zatoichi Meets the One-Armed Swordsman,
Right.
I don't know, months ago, and that was kind of a merger or a melding, an encounter, if you will, between Japanese samurai action cinema and Hong Kong action cinema, I think you're a little better steeped in the history of Hong Kong and Chinese cinema. So maybe give us a little bit of background. What was it that led up to Bruce Lee coming back to Hong Kong? I mean, he was born in San Francisco while his family was kind of touring the country. So he has kind of a dual citizenship, I think maybe is what the case. But he had been in California since his late teens, I believe. But, tried to make a go of it in Hollywood, did his little stint on The Green Hornet, the TV show, kind of a almost like a Batman spin-off or kind of part of that same kind of style of action TV making. But he ended up having to go back to Hong Kong. So tell us a little bit about the backstory there. What got Bruce Lee into this situation? It wasn't really his first choice. He wanted to make a go of it in Hollywood, but kind of ran into some dead ends there.
Well, yeah, and actually, he actually had a career in Hong Kong before he went back to the States because he came, he was born in San Francisco, like you said, but then as a baby, I mean, he made his first appearance in a movie as his father was working in film at the time. In fact, they're on film together, I think, in one particular movie. But then at 18, he finished his last film there, like you said, came to the United States. And when he came back to Hong Kong, and his father had passed away at one point, so he was coming back and forth. But when he got here, he realized that the Green Hornet was known in Hong Kong as the Kato Show because he was prominently in the show. And so, and being a Chinese, it was like big news. So when he got out here, suddenly everybody was like interested in him and he had no idea. So that was more or less how he got to where he is with Golden Harvest, which is kind of interesting because there was a little bit of back and forth with the Shaw Brothers going on at the same time. And interestingly enough, Golden Harvest was started by Raymond Chow and then Lo Wei, who was a prolific director for the Shaw Brothers from the 60s to the early 70s, was now joining him. So you had these sort of defectors from the Shaw Brothers starting Golden Harvest that then get Bruce Lee, and it kind of created over the next few years of Bruce Lee's life a little bit of this tension that was built up between the two companies for a while over for Bruce Lee. But that's how he landed this part, and he actually wasn't intended per se to be the lead. It was going to more be James Tien's movie, and they had a different director on it actually in the beginning, the first week or two of shooting. But then as it progressed, they sort of pushed James out. James plays his friend in the film who gets killed off midway, or his cousin, and so then it just became Bruce Lee's vehicle. And like Richard was pointing out, which I think is when you were going with, I think is really important to point out, is that sort of transitional moment, 45 minutes into the film when Bruce finally lets loose. And this is an attribute or a trope of Bruce Lee's movies. They always kind of hold him back a little bit in the films. There's always a reason. Fist of Fury, it's the teacher saying, don't fight, don't fight. In Way of the Dragon, it's sort of, hey, we'll take care of this for you. There's always this element they've played with within his movies about holding him off a little bit. But this film specifically with his necklace, really stands out. And I think to wrap that up, that point up, what's so interesting about it is that keep in mind that Bruce Lee is joining the Hong Kong film system with these traditionally trained, you know, practiced actors. The fight scenes had all been a certain way. It was definitely at that point where knives and bloodletting was big. And he comes in, a guy who's, you know, like you said, 19 till, you know, in his 30s, was raised with, you know, was hanging out with McQueen and Coburn. He was, he was the 60s culture of America. So he brings with him not just his martial art that was so, stuck out so much, but it's his personality and his swagger and his, you know, his Americanized, you know, personality in a sense, stuck out quite a bit. So then when he fights, and you watch this film, you'll see how all the other fight scenes, there are a lot of flailing arms, and everybody's kind of just whacking their way through it, and whack, bam. There's no real technique to it. And then Bruce comes on at that moment where the necklace comes off, and he fights, and it's like he comes in with a couple of quick techniques, and then it's just a pause. And then they wait, they beat, and he hits a guy. Then they beat, and he hits another guy. So they really played that up pretty well, I think. And that coupled with what we just mentioned with Bruce Lee being such a different entity than the rest of them, I think it really stood out at that moment. And it was a big, at the premiere, apparently, everyone went nuts at that moment in the film, and nobody even really knew who Bruce Lee was.
Well, he absolutely has this ownership of the screen, and I don't know what it is about him. I mean, is it his haircut? Is it his physique? Is it just and the way he postures himself. I mean, I guess I'm sort of sitting here looking at what is it that, I mean, because you're right, there is an absolute difference, and I guess maybe we can start talking about the film itself. The Big Boss is again, help me understand kind of where this fits in terms of the traditional martial arts film, but to me it felt like kind of a traditional morality play, if you will. You've got sort of the young man sent to work out of country, but he's kind of from the sticks, so to speak, but he's sent to Thailand from his home in China by his father to get an honest job and to make a living and to save some money and to support the family and maybe start a business of his own someday. So, he's obviously a guy from a very humble working class background, but he's learned a little kung fu along the way. And the very first kind of fight scene we see is after Joanne this is the Bruce Lee character, has landed and is kind of settling in. He goes to meet Brother Zhu, the James Tien character, and it's kind of like he stops at a little roadside food cart, and there's a bunch of guys who are, eating food and refusing to pay for it. And then all of a sudden this big brawl breaks out and it's like, oh my goodness. So it's like, and it's just like, these guys are just meanies, it's like, I'm going to eat the food and I'm not going to pay for you for it. And he slaps this little boy and knocks him to the ground. And it's like, these guys are just absolute, jerks, And so they completely deserve to get their ass kicked. And so it's like the most elemental type of, these are bad guys, these are good guys, the good guys are going to kind of take it out on them. And it's, all of a sudden, it's just like you've got this kind of big melee that's breaking out. And then as soon as the authorities show up, they all kind of, as a group, run together off to this kind of secluded back alley and continue the fight. So it's just like, okay, here we go, And you're right, there's almost a, I don't want to be too demeaning or snobbish, but there's almost like a slapstick element to some of those early fights. It's just like whacking and smashing and kicking and flailing, like just like you described it. And I'm just like, I was watching it with my wife. It's like, this is just kind of a few stages removed from the Three Stooges in some ways. It's just in terms of whack, smash, bump, and then the sound effects too are pretty amazing. But I'm just like, wow, this is pretty wild. Just the conceit that, a verbal disagreement all of a sudden turns into this kind of bare knuckles brawl is pretty amazing. Obviously, a lot of these had become conventions of a sort and is really the pretext to let these guys show off their techniques. I mean, is that a fair assessment of what kind of is the appeal of a lot of these martial arts films is, the action sequences where the guys really show what kind of fighting methods they've developed, and you just kind of have a visceral thrill from watching them kind of go at it.
Yeah, and as you guys were saying, first off, these films are like the Chinese Westerns. You know, that's what they were, the traditional
right.
sort of, B, sometimes they were B, sometimes they were A. You get the King Hu movies, which kind of elevated them a little bit, or Chang Che or whoever. But that's the other thing that we were just discussing, was that this was a moment where many of these fighters and these, or I should, that was, should say these actors, were not always fighters. You know, a lot of them were movie actors that were even like people like Jimmy Wang Yu and the rest of them that were fairly notable. They weren't really fighters to begin with, so they were actors, and that, which is fine. You know, I mean, it's not every actor that goes in and plays a boxer has to be an actual boxer. But what happened is that when Bruce came in, like we were saying, he stepped it up. And that suddenly you were looking at a guy and you were like, I think this guy really knows how to fight. And so what you were, sometimes it's referred to as the chop and block techniques, these sort of pre... I mean, they still went on for a while, but the pre-early 70s, there's a lot of this, the arms are just kind of come down in a chop, the leg goes up in a kick, and it's just it's sort of haphazard. You don't know if the guy's skill or not. And you're right. I guess in a sense, that is sort of how we look at the Three Stooges sometimes. And even then, this film has those moments where they go into those Three Stooges moments. You know, I mean, Lo Wei is not above trying to put something silly into his movies, which Bruce Lee actually had an issue with at times, like the man-shaped hole in the wall. That was not something Bruce Lee was really excited with, but they went through and did it anyway. So it's pretty iconic now, but I mean at the time.
Yeah, that's kind of a Looney Tunes move, you know, if you will, or Tom and Jerry or something like that.
I've often thought one of the good comparisons for people who've never watched martial arts films for what kind of films they're like is to think about musicals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where the point of a musical or a certain kind of musical is to have musical and dance numbers, right? And you set up a plot that leans into those moments of the film, and the plot only needs to, in a lot of musicals, only needs to be good enough to get you to these moments. It's about those moments, and in many senses, a martial arts film is about getting to fight scenes and getting a plot in that motivates fight scenes and lets people demonstrate their prowess. And in a sense, the transition to Lee is a bit like the transition from the old style musicals to Gene Kelly, who suddenly had this incredibly different physical way of dancing.
Yeah.
Like Lee kind of comes in and he's a different person.
Right. Yeah. Gene Kelly could do things that are like, and Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, Criterion did Swing Time earlier or last year. And you're right. That movie is kind of, dismissible until you get to the magic of Fred and Ginger doing their thing. And same with Gene Kelly. He can do physical stuff. He can leap onto tall surfaces and just, contort his body. And there's a primal athleticism that is like exhilarating beyond, you forget what the story was about. You just remember the image of him moving across the screen. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic analogy.
Yeah, I mean, it's great because you would imagine if in those dance movies prior to Gene Kelly, nobody knew how to dance and they were just sort of faking their way through it. And then he jumped down the screen. That's kind of probably exactly what it would have been like. It was like, holy crud,
Yeah. Yeah, so okay, well let's get back to the big boss here a little bit. So we see this kind of transition going on. Where was Chinese cinema in terms of when the big boss came out, it was kind of a big sensation because Bruce Lee kind of brought this new charisma, this new energy to it. Let's just talk a little bit about how it got to that moment. I mean, what is this story of kind of the young man who's being held back by some kind of vow, some kind of advice to refrain from fighting. Was that a common trope, or was that really just kind of a tension builder because we knew that when Bruce was finally unleashed, it was going to be kind of mind-blowing? Is this kind of something that occurred in other films of this genre, or was this kind of something that was kind of cultivated for Bruce Lee in particular?
I've never really seen it used per se that way prior to this. And I think that it was a little bit of luck in the sense that I don't think any of them really knew how great Bruce Lee was going to sort of come. This film broke all the box office records set by Tora Tora and Sound of Music at the time. So I don't think anybody had any idea this was going to happen. You know, Bruce Lee goes out and does what he is assuming is going to be his Clint Eastwood, you know, going into Italy and making and just doing a movie or something. And it, but I think that that aspect of the holding back, again, now this is kind of in lore a little bit, you know, rather than actual fact, but it, this was supposed to be James Tien's movie. And so there's an element, too, of people arguing that Bruce Lee wasn't fighting so much in the beginning just because they weren't really sure how they were going to use him exactly. So it did end up playing into their favor, I think, in that regard. Maybe they held him back a little too long, but at the same time, they also hint at it a little bit. You know, he's got a couple of little moments where he, that sequence where they have the fight early on, where James Tien's fighting the guys at night, and Bruce gets in with a couple quick little moves, which is interesting to watch because in that whole sequence, James Tien's fighting these guys. Never once does he knock any of them out. Bruce Lee hits them once, and they're both unconscious. So it's sort of like they kind of knew what they were doing. They were hinting at Bruce, you know, and what he was going to do. And so, I mean, there was obviously some forethought into it. And but I think it was a fairly, that was part of the reason why I think it helped with the success, was it was a little bit of a new trope. It wasn't something that was so overused at that point.
Well, and I kind of ask about that because the idea of the, you know, the killing machine who's kind of put in check, even the TV series Kung Fu was kind of based on this whole idea that I don't want to fight, don't make me have to fight you, you know?
Yeah.
But then when they finally kind of cross that line, it's like, okay, all bets are off. Now I'm fury unleashed, you know? And that seems to, even into non-martial arts, even just a conventional, just straight up action movies, that idea seems to have really kind of settled itself into an archetype, you know, like I've got all this destructive potential and I don't want to have to use it, but you just pushed me, you know, beyond my limits. And now, you know, here we go. And so that's interesting to see that this is maybe, I guess, you know, the Westerns sort of have that as well, you know, the quick draw, the assassin, the gunslinger who really wants to put him away and never step into the, you know, into the street again, but you finally pushed him and there it is. So yeah, I kind of see how that tradition has established itself there.
I think one of the things to also keep in mind is that Golden Harvest are a bit of an upstart company at this point.
Yeah. Right?
Raymond Chow has left Shaw Brothers and is trying to make films that are kind of exploiting a little bit of the thing, a little bit of the weaknesses that Shaw Brothers had at that point, because they were very staid at that point company. And I think one of the things that's going on here is that Golden Harvest are looking for new things to do.
Yeah, they're trying to be innovators, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got Lee because they offered him a lot more money. Like Shaw Brothers offered Lee a contract, and it wasn't very much, like $2,000 a film, and Golden Harvest offered him $10,000 for this, or $5,000 for this film, and $10,000 for a follow-up film. And they were really trying to do new style of film in 1971. And I think that's part of what's going on here, not just with that plot machinations, but setting this in the modern era and making it a more gritty crime film as opposed to a historical film.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction, too. I guess martial arts films kind of fall into two general camps, one set in the current times and one that are more almost costume productions, historic, you know, and there's definitely a lot of appeal to both styles, you know. But Michael, you want to kind of elaborate a little bit more on that, just kind of the different subgenres within martial arts films?
Well, yeah, you did. I mean, this was also a period where the idea, and Shaw Brothers was really, you know, pushing this, was the knife fighting stuff and the the sort of red orange hammer productions blood was very prominent. And this was actually the second Bruce Lee film. I'd seen Enter the Dragon when I was 9, and I thought it was a monster movie when I went into it because I thought there was a dragon in it. But I was so taken by Bruce Lee that two years later, my stepmother, and I hear I'm now 11 years old, took me to see this film. And I remember being a little shocked because Enter the Dragon, kind of, they saccharine it up a little bit. It's got, you know, the prostitution and the drugs, but it's sort of James Bonded out a little bit. And in this film, it's not. People are getting stabbed left and right and put in naked bodies put in ice and blood everywhere. So it was a little over. But that was very common at the time. And so another thing about Bruce coming into this was he started to say, let me get away from the knives. I don't need the knives to beat these guys. You know, let me do it with my fist because I can showcase that off more. And So there was, in that regard, too, a pull from the knife fighting that was so prevalent at the time. And so this was, you know, definitely considered what would be a B movie. Like, you know, even Bruce knew it when he would write letters back to his wife. He's like, it's going to be one of those movies. You know, I'm out here losing 12, 15 pounds shooting this thing in Thailand, and I'm going to come home with nothing. And, you know, but what the heck, you know. So yeah, at that time, that's exactly what was going on. And then when Bruce came in, and this, now granted, there's a lot of films. Shaw Brothers continued to make their films the way they did. Bruce did have a shift in the way productions were made, but that's how this Bruceploitation thing came about too after his passing. And you know, it's interesting too on the Shaw Brothers note is that when Bruce Lee was shooting Enter the Dragon, at this point, he was not happy with Golden Harvest and Raymond Chow, and he actually, during the production of that, went over to the Shaw Brothers and shot a number of these publicity stills for a potential production he was going to do with them in the period regalia and the long hair. And so there's some great images that survive that you get an idea of what Bruce Lee might have looked like in, you know, Come Drink With Me Part 2 or something.
Yeah, because he never did any kind of old school historic type of thing.
But his next one after this, the follow-up to this, which is by far my favorite Bruce Lee movie from a filmmaker's perspective, I think it rivals anything the Shaws did, Fists of Fury, does take place in like 1908, so it is a slightly historical, so you'll get there next.
Okay, cool. Well, and one of the things that kind of I was going to jump in earlier that I've kind of picked up from your comments here is that the Big Boss was a little bit maybe made up as it went along. The idea that this was going to be James Tien's movie, and then once they sort of recognized what they had with Bruce Lee, his screen presence, looking at the Daily Rushes and all of that, I think there just had to be some pretty obvious recognition that Bruce had that certain something that just jumped out at you. Even the early scenes where he first is kind of getting to know this family that he's staying with, and you know, the old uncle is talking about you know, all, just kind of jibber jabber, just kind of, oh, the young people aren't working as hard as they used to, or you know, all the people are leaving the country, and he's just sitting there, you know, kind of blustering and kind of snoozing off at the kind of the boringness and making eyes at the you know, the cute young woman sitting across the way from him. I mean, those, it's kind of an off moment, just kind of a throwaway type of scene, but it's very important to establishing his character as having just a little bit of swagger, just a little bit of charm that you don't see, you know, coming forth quite the same. I mean, his other characters are likable, they're maybe comical, or they've got, you know, a little bit of presence to them, but Bruce is just kind of this incredible package. But let's just talk a little bit about the filmmaking process. It sort of seems like somewhere in the middle of the production, they kind of shifted gears, which implies to me that they kind of had the skeleton of a plot or a story, but it sort of developed in the making of. Is either of you have any kind of insight as to kind of how that transitional moment occurred and maybe what sort of tipped the balance to make this a Bruce Lee movie versus Bruce Lee as a co-star or as a supporting or second lead or something like that?
I'll just add that, it, like I said, it was originally a James Tien starring project, and they did have a different director that Lo Wei had just rolled out of Shaw Brothers. I don't know if it was Invincible 8 or I can't remember what the last film he'd done there, but he'd then just, this would be his first, it was either first or second film for Golden Harvest at this point, and once they sent him out there, he decided, you know, like he did with Jackie Chan later, you know, that this was going to be somebody that was going to stick out. So he's the one that sort of pushed, somebody just drove by, that was pretty loud. So Lo Wei had the sense about him to determine that Bruce Lee was going to stick out. And so he did make that call. Now, him and Bruce Lee ended up having a terrible, terrible relationship later. In fact, 2 weeks before Bruce Lee passed away, it's written in all the papers, they almost got into a fist fight on a studio, and Bruce Lee had to go sign legal documents that he wouldn't attack him again. It was pretty big news. In fact, a lot of people, the legend is that's tied up and part of the reason why Bruce Lee is no longer with us. But the thing is that, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Lo Wei came in, decided that the direction should be more about Bruce, and then started shifting it. And on the filmmaking process, I think one thing about Lo Wei is he sort of has this legend about him and this notorious kind of personality of watching. This is part of the reason that Bruce had a hard time with him, of just like listening to the dog races on his radio when he was directing. You know, it's like he'd bet on things, so he would sit there and just listen to watch. But at the same time, I can tell you, if you, and you've seen enough kung fu films like I do, there is a certain, and I've compared some of his work with other cinematographers, so I can't quite lean it on them because it's pretty consistent with his work. But number one, and you can see it through this film, he does rely on a lot of dolly shots, where a lot of these filmmakers at the time, the cheaper ones, would stick with the zooms. Now, there are zooms in this, obviously, for effect. But, you know, you'd, instead of like being lazy, you know, being lazy where you just put on a long lens and, you know, start on the 150 millimeter end of it and then pull back to the 35 millimeter and get two shots and one setup, you know, he would actually use the dolly or change the setup. So that was something that I do notice he kept up through his career. So that, you know, there's a little credibility for him there. The other thing I do notice, if you watch, and this film particularly, because there's so many characters so often, his staging is actually pretty good. If you sit and watch some of the group shots where they're sitting down at the table or all converging at the ice factory or whatever, you watch when everybody stops, nobody's being like barred or muddled, and it's not too contrived either. So there's a real nice play on the staging of the actors, the compositions, and sometimes even with the colors they're wearing. Like Bruce, you'll notice usually they'll have like a group on the left side of frame, a group on the right, and there's a little opening in the middle, and they keep sticking, or off to the right or the left a little bit, and there's Bruce right there, and he's got a white t-shirt on or something. So there was some consciousness, I think, to the framing and how it was being conveyed visually. But, you know, again, I do say that this film, as far as I'm concerned, of all of Bruce Lee's completed films, his four films, this, Fist of Fury, Way of the Dragon, Enter the Dragon, I think suffers the most from just being, you know, maybe rushed or a little amateur. The pacing of the story, there's a lot of back and forth. Who killed? Where are they? Let's go talk to the boss. Oh, no, they went to the police. That kind of muddles it up a little bit in terms of the momentum, I think, and focus. And you're not even really sure who the bad guys are for a while, per se. You know, there's an old, the bad guy, the big boss really refers to Bruce Lee's character, but it sounds like it refers to the main character. Anyways, I got a little on a tangent there, but I'm just saying that I think Lo Wei does, for his problems, I think, have at least an eye in some ways, you know, for his subjects.
Yeah, and so we talked about Lo Wei a little bit. I mean, he had been a fairly accomplished director at this point. And,
yeah, 20 years.
Yeah, so this was, you know, kind of a steady hand. I think he's got both writing and directing credits on this film.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, let me just ask, have you dug like further into the back catalog of Chinese martial arts cinema prior to, you know, this kind of eruption, if you will, of Bruce Lee?
only a tiny little bit. I know that Lo Wei made one film for Golden Harvest before this that stars James Chen, the Chase, and starred Nora Miao, who's the drink vendor in this.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple Lo Wei films that just came up on the Criterion Channel. Spiritual
Really?
Kung Fu and Half a Loaf of Kung Fu, I think, are the two titles.
Yeah,
they're like
Jackie's films.
Yeah, late 70s films. These are Jackie Chan movies then? Is that?
Yep. Okay. Yep. He did a few films for him. In fact, just on that note, he did the sequel to the next film, Fist of Fury. The sequel Lo Wei did with Jackie Chan replacing Bruce Lee. So there's a whole dynamic with the sequels to Fist of Fury whenever you get to that episode that are worth investigating. But yeah.
Okay. Well, Michael, and both of you guys, you'll be my go-tos for future Bruce Lee and martial arts films. Well, let's go back to the big boss then. So you know, maybe just a little bit about James Tien. Tell me just a little bit about who he was, what he represented. You've mentioned a couple times that this is supposed to be kind of his film, and he's credible. I wouldn't, you know, necessarily slag him. I think he's definitely kind of a pale competition as far as Bruce Lee, but yeah, is there anything to be said about his career both before and after this film?
Well, yeah, I mean, he was you know, acting probably only about 4 or 5 years before this film, so he just sort of came onto the scene, and, you know, he wasn't maybe a big, huge star, but he was definitely a leading man for the low-budget mm-hmm. movies. And Bruce actually used him, you know, I mean, he was used in the next film, and then Bruce brought him back for Game of Death. Now, the Game of Death that'll be on on the Criterion version won't have him because they had to cut out all his scenes to make it work for their version of the film. But he, you know, he did have quite a career. I mean, he was working all the way up into the early 90s, and he even did in the 70s, Evanera, which is a I forget the Italian translation, the American translation, but it was, you know, an Italian period film, you know. So he's gotten around a little bit as an actor, but you're right, he's no Bruce Lee. He doesn't have he certainly doesn't have the fighting skills, another trained for the movies kind of guy. But you know, he was a good enough looking, happy go lucky character that they, you know, he played a lot of bad guys, but he certainly made his, and Lo Wei loved him because he used him often.
What would you say, he's an actor who kind of learned a few skills, kind of one of that kind of group of performers?
Yeah, and again, I think if you watch him, it's almost like what a lot of those actors were, what we would consider here stuntmen. They're not the stuntmen themselves. They come out, they learn some basics for fights. They don't have to be great fighters. They just got to know how to sell the punch and sell the hit, you know. And that's kind of what he does. You know, you watch the scene particularly where he gets killed, and you can see he's got, you know, some a modicum of ability, but it's mostly him just sort of plotting his way through it and just, you know, doing the best that he can to sell it like he's worried or mad or angry or whatever it is that he is, you know, and taking the fall and wiping the blood off and hopping back on the boat to Hong Kong to do what's next, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, he shows up a lot. He shows up a lot as like third or fourth guy in a film, which is
sure. Yeah.
Really, like not to be dismissed.
Well, right. He will show up. He'll put in an honest day's work, and he'll get the job done. Is kind of what I'm picking up here from your comments. Well, let's just get into the big boss then. I mean, we've kind of alluded to some of the basic story. Again, the young man working abroad. Gets a job in an ice factory. He's made a vow to his late mother that he's not going to use his kung fu skills. He's going to earn an honest living and avoid, you know, crime and fighting and violence and all of that.
Which is a fill-in, by the way. Originally in the story was because his father was killed fighting, so the mother was making him promise to not be like the father. So.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Because it was his uncle who was sending him off at the beginning.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
It wasn't. So there's a serious reason, and just that sense of obligation. I've got to take care of my family. I can't get involved in the rough stuff here, because if I die, then people are going to suffer back home, you know, or if I get arrested or whatever. But you know, the necklace breaks, the little jade ring that was kind of his vow of commitment. After he's smacked around a little bit and is just holding it back with everything he's worth, finally the line is crossed. And you know, that was the thing that kind of struck me, was there is some kind of almost like horror level brutality that goes on here. I mean, the murders, you know, sawing up bodies and encasing them in ice, the drug smuggling operation. I mean, that seems kind of par for course, but when it got into some of the gruesome aspects, it's like, whoa, this is some pretty dark stuff here, as well as the big, you know, the boss's kind of predilection for preying on women and killing everybody who doesn't quite toe the line, you know, doesn't quite buy into the corruption and the scheme here. And I also picked up a little bit of sort of some class dynamics, you know. I mean, thinking about, you know, kind of poor working class people, some of the scenes of like how they're sleeping in these little nettings, and you know, there's kind of an anonymous everyman aspect to these guys lining up to work in the ice factory. They're all just kind of hanging out, kind of hard beaten down, and of course all the money is being scooped up by, you know, the bosses, and they're just getting their little pittance of wages. So yeah, I'm not sure that this was a huge sort of social neo-realistic commentary on society or anything, but at the same time I did sort of pick up on that, and I figured a lot of kind of working class ordinary folks who watched this would kind of resonate with that that undercurrent of, like, you know, people who just put in a hard physical day's work, get their pennies out of the process, and see all the wealth being, you know, sucked up by people who are just sort of sitting there in the cool of the shade, sipping their drinks and living the good life.
Well, and that's not lost on Lo Wei either. There's a couple of juxtaposed edits where you have, remember when Bruce Lee's at their place getting drunk and mm-hmm. having their quote-unquote lavish meal. I mean, there's like this tiny little room, but still, it's it would jump cut from that to the meal that they're eating on the table back at the house and how sparse it is. And they
right.
And you know, they had that, and then they had that next sequence another couple of minutes later where Maria Yee's talking to Agun and saying, hey, you know, I think they're saying, oh, he'll be okay. Believe me, he's out there looking for the guys right now. And then it cuts and he's lying in bed with a prostitute. You know, so there is a little bit of this idea of Lo Wei was making that conscious separation.
Everything you want to know about the boss figure is that every time he has a conversation with somebody, he has that woman behind him massaging.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's it is kind of comical just how pampered the guy is, and but it's, you know, again, there's not a lot of subtlety, if you will, to this, but okay. I mean, they're kind of throwing the messages out there, and I do appreciate that element. That's actually one of the things I want to, you know, continue digging into as I kind of deepen my familiarity with this genre, is beyond the, you know, incredible and amazing choreographed fight scenes, what other kind of messages, content, stories are being told here? Because I do appreciate the context that they're putting these action scenes into. And so, you know, so after all of these kind of supporting characters, the supposedly James Tien are pretty viciously murdered at the behest of the big boss.
Right.
Chuan, Bruce Lee's character, recognizes and he comes back home after his night at the brothel there, where he's busted as he steps out the door. I mean, a nice little bit of timing as the young woman, I can't remember her name right now, but she sees him and he just, he kind of books it as fast as he can out of there. Then he goes back home just to kind of get a change of clothing and realizes that that whole family's been slaughtered. And, I mean, that's absolutely the last straw, which is basically the setup. He goes back to the ice factory, sees the corpses of his kinfolk that have been murdered, and just realizes just the depth of corruption and exploitation that not just he, but his people have been subject to. And that just gives the rest of this film all the righteous indignation that you would need to justify, you know, the brutality that is about to follow. So, what are your thoughts on just kind of the climactic finale and kind of the whole arc of this story?
Well, there's one thing that's interesting about it, that there's some legends with this film that some of them we know for a fact exist, which was some sequences were cut out. And one of the sequences that did get cut out, and it's because it's been talked about by Bruce Lee in interviews and even the directors talked about it, is that once the Bruce Lee character, who's based on a real person, by the way, we were in the late 1800s, this Chinese who came over and fought these Thai tyrants, and there's actually a statue of him up in Bangkok somewhere. The idea is that he came when he found everybody dead, and then you have that scene with him by the river, the water's flowing, you know, he's got all his worldly possessions. It depends on which edit you see. In some cases, you're hearing a narration about him, like, pulling everything together in his head, and some you don't. You just see him staring at the visions he sees now in the water of his now lost family, which includes a little kid. You know, they were not above taking out the kid. But, what had happened originally, as an interesting sort of note to what he was trying to say, Lo Wei, was that he goes from that scene of throwing his belongings into the water back to the brothel. And he goes into the brothel, he goes upstairs, he just grabs a girl and just throws his clothes off and has sex with her. And now some of these actually shots appear in the original Mandarin trailer, for those interested. If you look up the trailer, you'll see a couple of clips of Bruce Lee throwing a girl on the bed and standing naked behind a couch where he's...
I mean, I've seen some of those are blocked still by the couch shots, but that's not naked. The edit I see.
And the whole idea...
Okay, yeah.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Okay.
Right, no, that's not... It doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, I mean, it does. It did at one point, especially after the premiere, as did the saw in the head and a few other shots that are missing from the film. But they were just removed because Lo Wei actually said that the prostitute was specifically removed because people thought, well, wait a minute, why is he going to go have sex when he was trying to indicate this is a guy that's kind of given up?
Yeah, he's
everything.
On a mission.
He's
going to
go turn into an animal
women,
and do
right,
the animal right. things, you know. So, right, exactly. And if you watch him, you know, and particularly how Bruce was smart with the way he did this, you know, and is that he played, and you see a little, if you know, especially me, I follow Steve McQueen a lot, and I sort of, you know, Steve McQueen had a lot of little tricks that he would do when he was acting, and I think Bruce picked up from them, but, you know, Bruce Lee was smart enough to play his character in a very sort of meek, head down, all shucks kind of way. But then when we would get into the fighting, he went into this kind of cocky, go, eating chips, you know, like nodding to people, pointing at them, you know. So he did that. That was kind of interesting, too, which was, again, something that I think stuck out to the audience at the time.
The funny, like, fallout of that deleted scene is that at the end of that deleted scene, he picks up a bag of shrimp crackers from the prostitute had. Yep. He's got them going into the fight scene, and it's puzzling why he has a bag of crackers.
Well, that is I didn't know that until you just mentioned that now. But yeah, the biting into the crackers when he's showing up, you know, gets into the big boss's compound for the second time, and he's there just to kind of do his dirty work and finish the job. And those are pretty iconic moments.
That's a McQueen move right there. That's Steve McQueen right there. Yeah, grabbing some props to like make you as an audience go, what the heck is he doing right now? You know, and it.
Well, he's just so cool that he's having a snack as he's about to just, you know, really kick ass and take these losers down. it amplifies his legend all the way. It's not just like, you know, I'm fighting and who knows how this is going to end up. It's like, I got this, you know, and it's just, it's completely cool and pretty awesome, you know, presentation as he's getting ready for the big showdown.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about some of these fight scenes. I mean, you know, on a technical level, even, you know, what are we, I mean, we're seeing there's some interesting stuff. I mean, when Bruce the first time he goes to the compound, he's got to jump over all these dogs, and it's some interesting quick cuts and edits, you know. He never takes the dogs on. I mean, it's kind of like even the brawniest martial artist is not going to want to take on a pack of four German shepherds at once, right? But he does kind of an evasion maneuver. But then, you know, when he's kind of come and gone and he's back in the compound, you know, the big boss sends his guys out there and, you know, he pretty much dispatches them. Pretty brutal stuff. But I don't know, is there any insight or any comments just on how that whole sequence was put together? You see Bruce, you know, he has some use of weaponry, but he doesn't really, you know, there's a couple times where he's got the knives. He does a nice little flip there with the fingers, you know, kind of the way he's holding the knives. It's again, very imposing, very impressive. Just the way he positions his body, it's like you do not want to mess with this guy, and that you don't get that. I mean, even though the other guys that are surrounding him are tall and lean and muscular and pretty good fighting shape, they just don't have that same intimidation factor that Bruce does when he grinds his foot into the ground, kind of, you know, bends his knees, you know, elbows out there. It's like, oh, this guy is nothing but trouble. It's just pretty amazing effect.
And I think you hit it earlier. What I've always said this about Bruce Lee. A lot of people think, you know, they go, oh, Bruce Lee was the great, that he's such a legend because he was just such an amazing fighter. And I think it's more about his charisma. I think his personality and his charisma made him the superstar that he was. And the fact that he had that fighting ability that he did have, you know, just accentuated the whole thing. And I think in this film, particularly because he was just, you know, this is his first feature, so Han Ying-Che, who plays the big boss, or plays the head of the organization, he was the action director, and he'd be the action director on the next film, too. But I think by the time you get to Fist of Fury or The Chinese Connection, the next film, you can see much more of Bruce Lee's influence into the fight scenes. Here, there's a little bit more of the jumps and the leaps that, you know, and some of the knife stuff that Bruce wasn't quite as into doing. But there's still some great sequences and it's real basic. I mean, there's nothing super, which I love about it, because again, Lo Wei wasn't afraid to let the camera run for, you know, four or five techniques, and sometimes in like overhead wide shots. So you get to really watch Bruce work, and you're not trying to hide the fact that he doesn't know martial arts by quick cuts. And it's not even a lot of, until the end fight, there's not even a lot of handheld work. It's a lot of it's on sticks or a dolly. But today it depends on what your interests are as an action connoisseur when you watch The Matrix or whatever. But I feel that there is some real old school two guys going out there and they're just going to show their best and we're going to put it on camera that really sticks out in this film.
This one still feels like a bit of a negotiation between the two of them, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Like the two of them sort of collaborated on trying to figure out how both of them could get their say in this sequence.
You know, Michael, I'm kind of interested in your perspective as a technician, if you will, somebody who's really can kind of watch these films and not just say, "Whoa, that's pretty awesome," but you know, the specific moves that are being used. I mean, I'm thinking of like the scene where Chauhan, Bruce Lee, and the boss guy are rolling around and their legs are kind of tangled up and there's kind of this like rolling on the ground thing and just some of the positioning of like how they're doing flips and how they're kind of getting the upper hand on each other and the back and forth there. I'm sure there's probably a name for each of these techniques or there's a specific what little I know of Kung Fu is that it's based on a response of what the attacker is doing and how to exploit whatever weakness their move reveals. I mean, it's not just, I'm just going to come at you like this wild man, but I'm going to study what your movement shows me and then respond to it and try to get the advantage there. So as you watch these guys kind of going about it, you know, kind of on the technical side, what are you seeing here? What kind of insight, discoveries, insider knowledge can you share with us from what you see in these sequences?
Well, yeah, like Richard was pointing out earlier, the negotiation idea. There is a little bit of that going on where Han Yun-che is doing what he's familiar with, which is a lot of Chinese grappling. You know, I've watched a number of his films, and you can see he does have a preference to put himself in certain techniques that, you know, showcase him. And there's like a lot of throws that are going on. But when you watch Bruce was clearly saying, let me throw some of my high round kicks and my hook kicks and my side kicks. And let me do some of my fast, you know, hand techniques, which, you know, if you by the time you get into the next film, Fist of Fury, you'll see a lot more of his ability to use his hands like rapid fire within three or four moves that you're kind of going, where does... And Bruce was smart. Like, he would sometimes in the choreography, he would alter his opponent's position. So you're not... You see Bruce's arms moving, but you're not quite sure exactly what he's doing. So it makes it seem that much more, like, quick, you know? And so here, you know, Bruce Lee was trying to introduce his Jeet Kune Do style, which is the way of the intercepting fist, which is essentially just a way of quickly stopping techniques before they get to you. So there's a lot of stop hits with his, somebody comes at you and he all of a sudden kicks them in the shin to drop them, or, you know, I think a lot of it's really showcased in the ice house when he first fights.
Yeah.
Where the guy pops out with a knife and Bruce just kind of looks at him, kind of thinks with his head for a second. If you watch it, he kind of darts at him with his head for a second. The guy kind of reacts and then Bruce waits and then he kicks the knife out of his hand and kicks him in the head. And it's all in one shot.
Yeah.
You know? It's like really fast. It's boom, boom. And just showcased him. And I think this end fight, as you were talking about, which at the boss's mansion, which was actually a brothel that they were very hesitant to shoot in because they don't like shooting at real brothels, but that's what they did. The sequence is actually really good. I don't think it quite stands up to some of his better ones that are to come, but I think there's some good, like the one you talked about, the moves with their legs locked. It just shows that they were trying to spice it up and create some variety. Let's get on the ground, let's do it on our feet, let's fly through the air. And so in that sense, you get a little bit of everything in the old school martial arts kind of fight. And like Richard again was saying, you're watching a little bit of a transference of sort of the way they were doing the fighting prior to Bruce, and then now Bruce coming in and doing his thing.
And then there's the final kill shot, which is the boss throws the knife at Bruce. Bruce kicks it in midair
and
shoots it right back into his gut. But that's not the final kill. Then Bruce comes in with this kind of, I don't know, grip of death. What is that? It's like he's kind of sticking his fingers and the blood is flowing. And what is that?
Well, no, what's really funny about that is that, first off, that scene got chopped out of the UK because it gave it an X rating, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead, Richard.
I didn't see that. The first time I saw the film, that wasn't in it.
Okay, well, what was the kill there? Was it just the knife in the gut?
Yeah, the blood dripping down. the knife, and it just, they're kind of closed in with each other. I just think there's one shot, if you watch it, when it starts, the shot starts on the bottom of Hanye Che's shirt, and the blood's dripping out, and the camera pans up, and you see Bruce's fingers inserted into his, looks like it's inserted into his rib cage.
Right.
And what's interesting about this is the thing that I'm working on, that even in this Criterion edition, they've done a little, you know, they've got a guy in there talking about Bruceploitation. I was so bummed they didn't come to me. But they've got Game of Death Part 2 in there. But there was a off of that move in The Big Boss, there was a series of movies that were made where people were looking for Bruce Lee's Kung Fu Finger Book. Like Bruce, there's a movie actually called, and it was the very first Bruceploitation film I ever saw, because I thought it was a Bruce Lee movie, called Bruce's Fingers. And there's another movie called Kung Fu Fever that has it. But there's this, I used to, and as a kid, it took me a while to get it. I'm like, what is with this Bruce Lee finger? I mean, it sounded like a terrible porno. But the reality was, it was based off of this move he does at the end of The Big Boss. Like, this was his finger technique, you know? So.
Okay, and so yeah, so you've got the knife in the gut, you've got the fingers in the rib cage, and then it's just like this brutal beatdown, this kind of first-person point of view of just Bruce just kind of flailing and punching the guy. I mean, it's a pretty visceral and vicarious thrill to have this thoroughly corrupt evil man just humiliated and punished. That seems to be the big payoff there, as well as the girl is set free and rescued. But what do you think about the conclusion where he appears to be arrested? Like, obviously there's dead bodies all over the place, and it looks like he's about to be, you know, run up as a serial killer or something like that, even though he's kind of a good guy. I thought that was kind of an interesting, slightly peculiar conclusion to the film, but I can certainly understand once the main villain has been dispatched, there's not a whole lot. You certainly don't need to go through, you know, court proceedings or something like that. What do you guys think of the final moments of the film?
Well, I'll just point out real quick before Richard says that's not like just by chance that they did that. That was actually something that a lot of the Hong Kong films would do, is the idea, because it was actually the pressure from the authorities that they wanted that when something that terrible happens, we've got to have some authoritative figure at the end come in and sort of take over. One of Bruce Lee's films will end with the police. Fist of Fury, End of the Dragon, Way of the Dragon, the police show up at the end of each film. So that wasn't necessarily just like, yeah, let's have the cops show up. You know, it was like he's got to get his comeuppance, and they have to sort of don't let this, you know, go unpunished.
Okay. So,
and as a matter of fact, just on a little side note, one of the rarest kung fu movies of all time is the follow-up to this movie, the sequel to this film. And I actually saw Tarantino's copy of it. And let's just say it might not be forever unseen. Let's just put it this point. But it's a horrible movie. I will point this out. It's a terrible movie. It's actually directed by the guy that plays the foreman in the film. You know, the guy that's the foreman at, not the guy at the ponytail, but the guy that works in the office there, and he's always dictating orders.
Okay. Oh,
yeah. You know, he's actually directs the follow-up and stars in it as the new Big Boss. And the movie itself is terrible, but it opens with the end of this Big Boss. So the film credits play over Bruce Lee having this fight scene mixed in with a double. They do a couple of shots, and then we actually go into one of the Bruce Lee exploitation actors in his first role as a Bruce-alike playing Bruce Lee in prison, and then we lose him for the rest of the movie. But just to point out that there is a, you know, sort of a sequence with these arrests that go on cinematically.
So there's kind of a code almost, like a production code where, you know, evil may not triumph. And even though, you know, nobody's going to say Bruce's character is evil, but he certainly has, you know, killed people. That's a very interesting dynamic. I wasn't aware of that. So thanks for, you know, kind of filling me in. Richard, do you have any comments on the conclusion, the finale of the film?
No, except that I'm really pleased at the thought that The Big Boss 2 might be released, which is what he's hinting at.
You can actually see the first, I think, 5 to 10 minutes of it on YouTube somewhere. It is up there on there, so you can see it. So,
All right. Well, we are kind of close to the time limit. I've got some other things I've got to get to, but really enjoyed the conversation, guys. I want to give you each a chance to just kind of wrap things up here. Any other points of the film? Any other bits? Maybe one question I have is there any kind of tension? I know, you know, Michael, when you and I talked a little bit about Zatoichi meets the one-armed swordsman, we talked a little bit about the rivalry, if you will, between Japan and China. I've talked in other podcasts about Japan and Korea kind of having their own cultural tensions. Is there any kind of a history of China versus Thailand? I mean, did the setting of this film resonate with its original, you know, Hong Kong audience in any particular way?
Well, I think I don't necessarily per se that there's not anything like along the lines of you know, what happened existed with the Japanese per se. You know, I mean, but with you, again, one of the things we will notice with particularly in Bruce Lee's films, but it would happen in other kung fu movies as well, is that there is a fish out of water element for Bruce. Bruce, in this one, he shows up, he's a Chinese that comes to Thailand. You know, in the second one, even though he was trained at this martial arts school, it's now, when he returns, it's been taken over by the Japanese. And in the third film, it's him going up against Italian gangsters, you know. So there is that element of, you know, us versus them that does exist in Bruce Lee's films, notably. But I don't think there was per se any kind of friction between the Thai and the Chinese, except, again, from the idea that Cheng Chao-an, the character that Bruce Lee plays, was based on a real character who did take on some tyrants in Thailand. But it was less of a racial thing, I think, and more just the fact that there was a bunch of gangsters in this village that he was taking mm-hmm. out. So,
cool. All right, well, any other final comments, anything that you want to touch on, Michael, before we wrap it up? And I'll kick it over to Richard after that.
Sure. You know, I think out of Bruce Lee's, you know, four films, I mean, I'm not counting Game of Death, I'm just counting the four films he completed, I've always, you know, found this to be the lesser of the mm-hmm. four in many ways, just in terms of how, but as I've gotten, and maybe this is, you know, maybe this is a kind of an interesting dynamic, you know, sometimes when as a kid you watch a film and you go with it from one perspective, and then as an adult and a filmmaker you start approaching it from other ways. But as a filmmaker later, I started to pay attention to more of the sort of the smaller micro elements that were part of this film, and just in its historical, like we were talking about, the perspective of how it branches from one thing to another, like before Bruce and after Bruce, you know. Even with the elements of Bruce Lee, like, you know, when he finds the bodies at the dead bodies at the house, you know, he's like, it ends with a really kind of a interesting sweet moment where he takes the one guy he was having the fight with towards the end, his one cousin, and kind of cradles him in his arm and puts his head against his head and sort of stroking his hair. And it's sort of very what you wouldn't anticipate being in a, like, a hardcore testosterone martial arts mm-hmm. movie, you know. And so there are these elements of this film that sometimes I go back, and even though I still sort of put it at the end, you know, right behind maybe Way of the Dragon, which is the one that Bruce Lee directed, just because I think it suffers from some of the pacing elements of the story, I still think it's a fun film to watch, just from, like we talked about, that perspective of watching Bruce become Bruce and seeing, you know, I mean, this is a group of Chinese out of, you know, not just Bruce Lee, but out of, you know, kind of out of their element. They shoot in Thailand, but, you know, they're out in the middle of nowhere trying to shoot this movie. So they managed to put together something that historically broke box office records, so is clearly a nice piece of cinema in that regard.
Yeah, it's a pretty important gateway film. Richard, what are some of your closing thoughts as we wrap up our conversation today?
Well, I'd say two things. One, I've noticed a lot of a fair number of folks who are like Criterion enthusiasts kind of dismissing the Bruce Lee films. And it's understandable because, like, you know, like a lot of genre films, these are very simple morality tales. They're not complicated art filmmaking, but I think there's been enough here to suggest to them that they could watch these looking for things that tell them why this is a very significant film, and not only why it's a significant, like, martial arts film, but why it's a significant 1971 film. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a transition from like a lot of films in 1971, a transition from an old way of doing things to a newer, more interesting way of doing things.
Yeah.
I don't.
And I think just.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, just in terms of just encountering some, you know, a different culture and understanding kind of life from a different perspective. I mean, that is so much of what I enjoy about Criterion films of all different sorts. And, you know, just because the, you know, the moral message or the plot elements, the, you know, the clear delineation of who's the good guys and who's the bad guys is maybe a little rudimentary or simplistic, doesn't mean that it's, you know, ignorant or that it doesn't have something substantial to say. I feel like even a lot of our, you know, what you might consider or might be, you know, viewed by many as more sophisticated films, they have their own conventionalities. I think this is just kind of a good stretching exercise for somebody like me who's, you know, been aware of Kung Fu and you know, sort of at a distance says, yeah, there's kind of a cool, fun element to that. But I'm definitely looking forward to the deeper engagement. You know, I mean, they put the Jackie Chan two features out, the police story films last year. Now they're going, you know, pretty deep into Bruce Lee. And it looks like, you know, at least on the Criterion Channel, there's other martial arts cinema on the way. I feel like this is a fascinating dimension. Obviously, there's other labels that go much further and deeper into the catalog than Criterion likely ever will. But to me, this feels like a very important aspect of global cinema that needs and deserves to be taken seriously. So, yeah, I don't know if you had any more you want to add on to your thoughts there, but that's kind of what I was thinking as you were speaking there.
The only thing is an aside. Well, the credited an issue of the soundtrack. Well, the credited guy is like Wang Fu Wang. Most of the music you hear is by the European composer Peter Thomas. Sort of does most of the music that you know from this film. But on the Mandarin soundtrack, you can hear that they just abruptly use music by Pink Floyd and King Crimson.
You know, that was interesting. I need to do a little bit of looking into that because I felt some of the music, the music that was used didn't always match the mood or the pacing of the scenes. But maybe that's just something I have to kind of acclimate myself to as well.
No, it's true. This actually, there's several different variations on the soundtrack.
Oh, wow.
It's like
okay.
Wang Fu Ling, who did do the original Mandarin. Peter Thomas, who's a German composer, did it for the U.S. and I think the U.K., I guess. But then Joseph Koo, who is a Japanese composer, he added elements also that show up in various versions that went to different parts of Europe. So you can get these, Richard was mentioning, Pink Floyd is in the, I think it was added for the original Cantonese, I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah, you're right, I'm
but,
sorry.
No, but I mean, it's always hard to always follow where they're, which versions. But of all of Bruce Lee's films, yeah, there's definitely a, you can almost watch, go on YouTube and pick different versions of this film, and you're going to get a completely different soundtrack to all of them. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic. But I love Peter Thomas's. It's got some of the jazziest, craziest sounding music, and gets repeated quite frequently in the next 10 years in other kung fu movies. They stole from that and dropped that theme into many.
So they basically just appropriate, just drop it in wherever it seems to fit, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm really quickly sneaking a peek at the Criterion page. I'm just wondering how many different soundtrack variations we're going to get, or what, you know. Well, I'm fascinated to hear more about this, and of course there's the English dub soundtrack versus the originals, and I'm sure, you know, even with what looks to be kind of like the authoritative Bruce Lee box set, some of you more hardcore collectors may not want to sell your other versions because there might be some variations that the Criterion won't include in their package. I don't know.
It's worth noting they didn't shoot sound on this, so the English dub is not a bad choice.
Okay. Well, it was interesting. I was watching it. I have a friend who's put it up on their Plex server that I have access to. But then when I was rewatching the last bit of it again this morning, it looks like the Plex server wasn't up. So I had to go onto YouTube and I found a Spanish language version. So when I rewatched the second half, it was in Spanish. And I have the most rudimentary familiarity with that language. But again, you know, the nonverbals definitely carry the story along. You don't need to know every line of dialogue to get what's happening there. But it is fascinating just to reflect on how this film you know, just speaks to so many different cultures. I think I saw a Hindi version and a few other variations on YouTube as I was searching around for an alternate feed there. Well, anyways, guys, I do have to wrap this up, but this has been a delightful conversation, as I fully expected it would be. Let's just go ahead and do a little go-arounds. Michael, anything that you want to share with us as far as, you talked a little bit about what you're up to. How about any links, websites, projects you're working on, anything specific you want to share?
Film-wise, I've got a movie that I just directed that's coming out shortly called Appleseed. So just, you know, you can pay attention to that. It was the last film that Ron Howard's father, Rance Howard, did. And I did it with Clint also was in it. Robbie Benson was in it, and Adrian Barbeau. Had a great little cast. And so we've got a distribution deal that looks like it's pretty solid, so it should be being announced soon. So that's one thing. And the other thing is...
Well, I was going to ask about Appleseed. I know I've spoken to you as this project's been in development. Is it going to be available online then, or how people are going to be able to access it?
Yeah. And we might be getting a potential exclusive deal with a cable company, that online cable company, streaming company, that might be picking it up for the first 6 months, which would be great because it'd be a lot of exposure that way. But it'll be out soon. I mean, we're just kind of nailing out the particulars of that. And then I've actually started working with a guy who I'm trying to, it's a very grassroots. We've only put out one release so far called The Leg Fighters. What I'm doing is my last 4 or 5 years, I've been out searching and finding old 35 millimeter prints, specifically about these follow-up Bruce exploitation movies that came. Because many of these, when I went to Hong Kong and Taiwan to do this documentary, I would find that none of these films exist anymore. They just got all thrown away, and Mona Fong from the Shaw Brothers would go dump them all in the ocean. I mean, it's like nothing really exists anymore except for some films that are kept by either old theaters. I found an old print in an Italian cinema that I managed to pull out, and different countries and stuff. But my point is that I'm doing trying to do a mini Criterion with Kung Fu films. So we put out, it's called the Pearl River Collection, and we've already put out our first one, which is The Leg Fighters. Our second one's coming out called Dynamo, and Dynamo is actually a Bruceploitation film, or in the sense of it stars one of the most famous Bruceploitation actors, Bruce Lai. But what we're doing is, the film itself is actually, you know, more commentary on the Bruceploitation movies, if anything. But I'm pushing this, you know, this new boutique label. I'm working with another company to do a much bigger version. They're actually working with Severn Films to put out something that's pretty massive and epic. So I've been in the restoration business of trying to save some of these poor, unforgiven movies from obscurity and YouTube for the last few years. So let's just keep your eyes peeled for that.
Well, definitely keep me updated, Michael. It sounds like some pretty exciting stuff you got going there. So looking forward to seeing those ideas and all that effort come to fruition. Absolutely. All right, Richard, any updates, any comments before we wrap things up?
Nothing as interesting as that, but you can find me on Facebook me on Facebook and Letterboxd.
Yeah. Okay, very good.
That's good.
Hey, it's good to have you both on. We'll be getting back to this when you get to Fist of Fury, and I think we got Touch of Zen coming up. Is that right, Michael? You're on the line for that fairly soon?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. If you want me, I'll be there.
Okay.
I would happily do it.
Well, we'll look you up when we get to that point in the timeline. But for now, we're gonna draw this episode down. So welcome to the collection, Bruce Lee. Been a great conversation, and we'll pick it up in the near future. So we'll be coming at you fairly soon. We'll not sure exactly what my next title is. I got a few different options out there. So see me when you see me. But thanks for listening, and everybody, we'll be talking to you real soon. Bye-bye.